Iran on the 5, veto-wielding powers of the U.S. Security Council plus Germany. Geneva 3, day 2. Details of the meetings are still kept behind closed doors. Some headlines: Iran says serious issues remain in nuclear talks. France, Iran, trade barbs, ministers say, come for nuclear deal. Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, has said details and wording of the document were being discussed with Iran's red line uranium enrichment under further discussions. And while the spokesman for EU's foreign policy chief says negotiations were meaningful, detailed, and substantial, Iran's deputy foreign minister says some major differences still remain. Stay tuned for another edition of the debate in which we ask, is the deal closer, or will talks end without an agreement?
In Geneva, the United States, Britain, China, Russia, and Germany are continuing talks with Iran. The Islamic Republic of Iran is pressing for the economic sanctions imposed on the country to be lifted. As the talks go on, a poll conducted by the Washington Post and ABC News has shown that 64% of the U.S. public wants an agreement with Tehran over its nuclear energy program. This is while Israel and some members of the U.S. Congress want more sanctions on Iran and call any deal with the country a bad deal. Alex Majumder, an activist with the International Action Center, explained why so many people in the U.S. are opposed to the ongoing sanctions and hostilities.
It is important that we, as people in the U.S., speak out against economic warfare and realize we as a people need to make our government realize we are not in the mood for war or in any form. A few months ago, when the U.S. was trying to bring about outright Western intervention in Syria, the people here spoke up.
As the talks continue, the U.S. has consistently voiced concern over Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program and rejected calls to lift its vast unilateral sanctions against Tehran.
We should keep in mind that many of the countries that Iran is in negotiations with uses nuclear energy. Some of them also have nuclear weapons. That's true. Iran has made it clear that they are not interested in nuclear weapons. They are interested in nuclear energy, and they have that right.
While the majority of the U.S. public overwhelmingly hopes for success in the negotiations, the poll also showed that many have low expectations about this actually occurring. As the talks resume, what result will take place is yet to be seen. Caleb Maupin, Press TV, New York.
Let me introduce our guest for this edition of the debate. Research Associate of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Jim Walsh, joins us from Boston. And from Answer Coalition, Brian Becker joins us from Washington. Gentlemen, welcome. Jim Walsh, I'm going to start with you. The purpose of this interim deal that's supposed to be under discussion in Geneva is to slow down Iran's nuclear program, as it's been reported, halting and rolling back some elements in return for limited sanctions. I'm guessing at this point that those have been met, especially the fact that the IAEA was in Iran, its chief, Yuki Amano, who signed an agreement with Iran. What do you think are the sticking points as we're looking at the second day and yet no agreement signed?
Well, you know, I am not surprised. I mean, this is scheduled for 3 days. Normally, agreements don't happen until the 11th hour, so I don't think we should be too nervous yet. But the sticking points are probably a function of what we saw during the last round. You'll remember that there seemed to be an agreement in hand. The foreign ministers and Secretary of State Kerry flew to Geneva. And then when the French foreign minister arrived rather late in the process, he had a series of objections, one of which has to do with the disposition of the Arak reactor, A-R-A-K, the Arak reactor. And the Iranian team has always said, in my discussions with them, they're happy to deal with that issue, but they want to deal with it in the second phase of the agreement, not in the first phase. The French were trying to push it up into the first phase. Presumably, if the P5+1 is going to demand more in the first phase, then it has to give more in terms of sanctions relief for this to be proportionate. So I think one issue is the Arak reactor. The other is there has to be some wordsmithing, some negotiation around the issue of right to enrich. Iran wants an explicit right to enrich. Other countries don't believe there is a right to enrich, but there's a way to get around that if people are willing to negotiate it. You can find language that would be suitable to both sides.
Brian Becker, why would world powers, particularly the U.S., want Iran to halt uranium enrichment when, as a signatory to the IAEA, it is within their right under Article 4 of the NPT?
Well, it's fundamentally political. This whole process has been political. The United States broke relations with the Islamic Republic of Iran after 1979. Prior to that, between 1953 and 1979, the U.S. Had in Tehran its own proxy government, the Shah, and during that time period, the U.S. encouraged the development of nuclear energy program by Iran. As long as the Iranian government was essentially a puppet or a client of the U.S. government in this geostrategically important part of the world, and of course a resource-rich part of the world, they were perfectly happy with Iran having nuclear energy. The nuclear issue has become an issue of the last years because the United States has continued to do what it has done ever since Iran had an independent government, which is to use economic sanctions and attempted economic isolation and military threats and other diplomatic pressure to destabilize the Iranian government, because in the long run, what the U.S. really wants is not anything other than what it used to have, which is a government in Tehran which functions as a proxy. In other words, it hopes to carry out regime change in Iran over the long term, and economic sanctions are a destabilization tool, and the nuclear issue is a convenient a provocation or a convenient pretext in order to do that. That's the long term project. Right now, if there is an if there is some agreement, there will still be very severe economic sanctions applied against Iran, even though Iran is complying with the IAEA, and the United States government, as a signer of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and the other four members of the Security Council, they have an affirmative obligation under the NPT to begin their own nuclear disarmament. But you don't really see that starting to happen.
Well, Jim Walsh, I'm going to come in a angle that's not particularly common regarding what Brian Becker said there in terms of regime change ultimately being what perhaps what the U.S. wants, perhaps some of the other countries want. And I'd like to go in on this angle. I mean, Washington and its allies, they've been reluctant to put the acceptance of Iran's nuclear enrichment pretty much down on paper because for a variety of reasons. Do you think that a couple of those reasons could be the fact that, it would put to null and void the UN resolutions that were put in place, and also in the future, if the U.S. ever wanted to, perhaps, Brian Becker said regime change, I'm guessing that's going to involve an attack on Iran, that Iran would say, listen, you agreed, it's on paper, you can't go to the U.N., it's not valid. Is that part of the perhaps reasons that the U.S. and its allies might not want this right to enrichment to be inked down on paper to get this interim agreement going?
Yeah, you know, I understand the narrative about regime change and the troubled history, but that's not what's going on here. First of all, it wasn't the U.S. that blocked the deal. Kerry wouldn't have gone to Geneva unless he expected a deal to happen. That's when foreign ministers show up. They don't show up just to chat. They show up because they expect a product, a treaty or an agreement. And so they went there expecting that. It was the French, not the Americans, that blocked that. So I think there's a problem with that particular explanation. I think more generally, you know, look, this first phase deal, Iran is going to stop producing 20% enriched uranium. They are going to do that. They're going to stop the 20% enriched. They will continue to have an enrichment program that will enrich from 3 to 5%. And the P5+1 is ready to sign on to that. So they're not asking for zero enrichment. The only people who are asking for zero enrichment are the Israelis and maybe the Saudis. But that's not the nature of the conversation right now. Once there is an agreement, whether it's a first phase or a second phase agreement, Iran will enrich. It'll enrich at 3 to 5%, but not higher, and it will have to put itself under a greater transparency. And in return, the U.S. and others will have to provide substantive sanctions relief. And that's the nature of the deal. And if the deal works out, then Iran will have a nuclear program, will have a limited enrichment program, but will take actions that give the international community confidence that it might not be used for other purposes. And then the Iran will have sanctions relief, and hopefully the U.S. and Iran will be able to cooperate on some issues where they have common concerns, like the stability in Iraq, the future of Afghanistan after a U.S. withdrawal, Syrian chemical weapons. These are all issues where the U.S. and Iran regionally have common interests. Hopefully a nuclear agreement will pave the way to more collaboration in some of these other areas. But that's assuming this all goes forward. But the deal is, the first part of the deal is stopping 20% for some sanctions relief and enhanced transparency. And then the other issues will be settled in a second part of the deal.
Go ahead, Brian Baker.
Well, I mean, we're working out of what's called conventional wisdom, which is Iran is the bad guy. Iran has enriched uranium to 20% and thus constitutes a threat, an existential threat to the entire rest of the world. While the United States and four of the other five members, including Germany because of the NATO sharing plan, all have large numbers of nuclear weapons, that unlike Iran, the United States keeps invading country after country in the Middle East. Iran has no record of initiating any war. Iran became targeted for regime change and hostility because it had a revolution, a people's revolution that overthrew the old existing puppet dictatorship that the US CIA imposed. And what Mr. Walsh refuses to talk about is if, because he assumes in this sort of framework of conventional wisdom, is that there will be some relief to sanctions if Iran stops producing uranium or enriching uranium at 20%. Well, the fact of the matter is, and he knows it, there will still be economic sanctions on Iran, even though Iran is complying with international law. Iran will perhaps be given a little bit more leverage, some relief from sanctions, but still economically devastating sanctions. What are sanctions? They're an attempt to use credit, finance, food, medicine as a tool of destabilization by powerful governments against more vulnerable governments. If we really want to have a nuclear-free Middle East, we could also start by saying, let's eliminate Israel's 200 to 400 nuclear weapons, which it developed along with in cooperation with France. But this is never discussed, as if those weapons are not an existential threat to the people of the Middle East. The injustice of these negotiations are not being discussed by Mr. Walsh because apparently he agrees with the framework that if Iran has nuclear energy, then it's an existential threat. But if American allies have nuclear programs, including nuclear weapons, or if the U.S. itself or the Security Council plus Germany have nuclear weapons, then it's not a threat to the world community. How does he explain this distinction? Why is Iran such a danger when the others can have these nuclear weapons?
Jim Walsh, go ahead. I saw your head shaking there.
Yeah, I mean, get real here, right? The Iranians have come to the negotiation. If everything you said was true and was terribly unjust, and it's all part, no, please let me finish. I let you talk. Please show the same courtesy. Why is Iran participating in these negotiations if everything you say is true? Obviously, they've chosen to participate in negotiations. They're looking for a negotiated outcome. That's a good thing. That's why they're in Geneva. So they don't buy the critique that you're offering. I agree with some of the individual things that you say. I think you're right to say that some sanctions will continue after an interim agreement because it's an interim agreement. And so if the U.S. doesn't provide sufficient sanctions relief that it promises in the first phase, then Iran is free to walk away from the agreement and go back to enriching 20%. No one in a negotiation is going to give everything up in the first round and wait to the second round for the other side to comply. These work professionally, not ideologically, but professionally. The way you negotiate is both sides give reciprocal proportional concessions and try to protect themselves. That's why, you know, you wait and see, you trust but you verify. Iran's going to wait and see if the U.S. follows through on its promises, and it's going to be skeptical. Iran and the U.S. is going to wait and see if Iran follows through on those, you know, and it's skeptical. That's what happens when countries have bad relations for 30 years. But the idea is this will be happen in structured steps. The U.S. isn't going to give up all the sanctions at the beginning. That's not going to happen, and no one in the right mind would expect that to happen. What they're going to do is, you know, a tit for tat.
Well, let me ask you a question.
You know, agreement.
That's
how agreements
work. I'm letting you speak, but you're speaking for a long time. Let me just ask you.
Go ahead, Brian Baker.
Let me just ask you a question. You ask me a question. Why would Iran be negotiating if the United States and the other side didn't have legitimate claims? That's kind of the implication of your question. The answer to the question is this. Iran lives in a world where the dominant part of the global economy includes the power centers, the economic power centers of Washington, of the United States, of France, of England, of the other Western countries. It has had imposed sanctions. It's unable to sell oil. It's had its bank assets frozen. Other countries can't do trade with it. Under these circumstances, under the circumstances of extreme pressure by countries that are fundamentally hostile to Iran and have been since it had a revolution in 1979, Iran has come to a negotiating table. There aren't carrots and sticks on both sides. There are carrots and sticks on the part of the Western side, which is saying to Iran, you must do this, this, and this in order to have some economic relief from economic sanctions we can impose on you. The powerful countries, including the United States, including England and France, the colonizers of the Middle East, they're so strong that no one can impose sanctions on them. No matter what laws they violate, no matter what countries they illegally invade or occupy, no matter when they use nuclear weapons, and of course the United States is the only government to have ever used nuclear weapons, no matter what they do, because they're part of the powerful, they do not get punished with economic sanctions. In other words, sanctions and the sanctions regime is not really about nuclear weapons, it's about the power relationships in the world. The United States knows that Israel has nuclear weapons. It knows it has Pakistan has nuclear weapons. They know all about the nuclear plans, and they also know that Iran has not initiated any war with a neighboring country. But that's not why they're doing this. They're doing it because they want to undermine Iran long-term through the mechanism of economic destabilization and weakening the country generally.
Jim Walsh, do you have a response?
And if that were true, they wouldn't be in if that were true, they wouldn't be in Geneva negotiating. I mean, this is such a parts of it are true, but this is just an ideological narrative
that's not
unrelated
true.
To the facts. The fact is, let me finish. You talked forever, so it's my turn. You know, they're in Geneva. They're negotiating. You know, you really insult and underestimate Iran. The picture you're portraying is Iran is weak and being forced to the table and being forced to give concessions. That's not the case here. I don't think the Iranian negotiating team believes that. I don't think President Rouhani, who I've spoken to personally, believes that, or the foreign minister, Javad Zarif, who I've spoken personally to about that. This is a confident negotiating team. They have a plan. They're in Geneva. They're going to get sanctions relief, and they're going to go back and show that there's an alternative path to both sides simply taking punches at each other in a lose-lose situation. To quote Foreign Minister Zarif, in a lose-lose situation where neither side accomplishes its goals. That's why they're in Geneva. If what you said was true, they wouldn't be there.
Well, Jim Walsh, let me ask you this. Western officials, they all accept that they have to, one way or another, accept on the fact that there has to be some degree of enrichment, obviously, that Iran is entitled to.
Yep.
And that has to eventually be settled.
Yep.
If you were part of the negotiating team trying to seal a deal on that particular point, how would you get them to agree to that?
Well, you know, first of all, the deal accepts Iranian enrichment. I mean, I've said this twice. I'm going to say it a third time. The deal accepts Iranian enrichment at 3 to 5%, which is that's the all you need if you're going to make uranium for a nuclear power plant. It's 3 to 5% enriched uranium, and that's part of the deal. Now, there's a separate issue about the right to enrich. You know, personally, like a lot of people who work on nonproliferation issues, I don't believe in the right to enrich. I don't believe the U.S. has the right to enrich. I don't believe France has a right to enrich. Enrichment is not in the NPT. If you read the document, the word enrichment does not exist. But, you know, this is important to the Iranians. And so this is what good negotiators do. They find a way to find language where both sides can walk away and feel satisfied. It seems to me that if this deal, which will go through, accepts Iranian enrichment at 3 to 5%, that is de facto recognizing that they're enriching. I mean, I don't know what more people want. I mean, I don't even know why it's the U.S.'s, it's not the U.S. America's job to go around recognizing this right and that right. People, you know, that doesn't flow from the U.S., that flows from treaties or sovereign rights. But in any case, I don't think it's a great idea if everyone thinks that they can all enrich. I think that's a proliferation nightmare. But there are ways to get around this, and this deal recognizes the fact that Iran will enrich at 3 to 5%. And then it's just a matter of finding language that makes people happy.
Yeah, they've been talking about this language for quite some time. Brian Becker, let's talk about the political side of this, which you have stated. Even the spokesperson for Catherine Ashton has said there's political advisors that actually are being consulted on this. And I'd like to come in on Israel, and I'd like to get your reaction on both Israel and Saudi Arabia, where at this point are set to have, a rift now have occurred between these two and the United States. How far are they going to go to try to make sure that this deal doesn't go through?
Well, the Israeli government, led by Netanyahu, is freaking out purportedly and insisting that any deal is a bad deal. Of course, for Israel, again, I do not believe they think that the Iranian government poses an existential threat. I think they, of course, having nuclear weapons of their own, hundreds of them, realize that that's not quite the issue. But I think Israel has a different political problem. Of course, Netanyahu has an internal domestic political problem, so he wants to change the subject and focus on the Iranian boogeyman. But more importantly for Iran is that in the long term, if there is any lessening of tension, and this is the Israelis' big fear, if there's any lessening of tensions between the historic enemies between that the United States has identified as an enemy, in this case, Iran, for instance, if there's any easing of tension so that there's a possibility of peace in the Middle East, that means Israel's role is less important to the United States and in fact, can become an abrasive part of the equation. In other words, Israel gets $4 billion a year. It's the largest recipient of U.S. and military foreign aid of any country. Constantly having war or the danger of war means that it's very convenient for the United States to have a proxy force that has a very big and powerful army that can act as an agent for Western powers and particularly for the United States. Israel starts to drop out of the equation, that's what the Israeli government fears, if there is actually any sort of rapprochement or detente or lessening of tensions. And so that's why the Israelis are against this. Back home, Obama's critics in Washington are the people who are the permanent military war hawks who always are afraid of any outbreak of peace because they either can't assert that Obama is weak or because it lessens their connection with the military-industrial complex, which knows that war is good business, military tensions are good business, the sense of constant danger is good business. So any outbreak of peace anywhere, or even the sense that there's a lessening of tension, is considered bad politics and bad business.
Let me just come in here. I'm sorry, Brian Becker. Jim Walsh, come to you. Deal or no deal, Jim Walsh, what do you think?
I'm still an optimist. White House sources, unnamed White House sources, said they expected a deal. I don't know what the French are doing, but, you know, it doesn't have to happen tomorrow. We're going to get a deal one way or another, I think. So I hope it's tomorrow. And by the way, you know, if this deal was so bad for Iran, why is it that Israel is opposing it? That should tell you there's a problem with the other side's arguments here. I think we will get a deal. I think it'll be good
for
Iran. I think it'll be good for the U.S.
Could, what my view
and
is
we can
on
put that on a different. Yeah.
Quickly, Brian Becker, go ahead, quickly.
Yeah, I think Iran is very strong. I think they're very composed. I think they know what they're doing. But I think what I'm trying to point out is the hypocrisy and double standard whereby nuclear powers and those who have invaded and occupied other countries, unlike Iran, are treating Iran as the rogue nation here when, in fact, Iran has conformed to international standards and international law when it comes to developing a peaceful nuclear energy program.
Thank you very much. Let me thank our guest, research associate of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Jim Walsh from Boston, and Brian Becker there from Answer Coalition from Washington. Thank you for watching another edition of The Debate. From the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.